You're listening to the USEA official podcast, which takes you behind the scenes of eventing, covering all the big events, professional tips and tricks, interviews, special guests, and the latest USEA eventing news. Welcome to the USEA official podcast. Now, my guest on today's podcast, listeners, is somebody I cannot wait to hear more about their career and their story and how they've got to where they are today, because it encapsulates all sorts, including the circus, which is going to be brilliant. She is a top farrier and her name is Bec Ratté. Bec, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your patience in my crazy schedule and getting me to be able to speak with you today.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. We really appreciate you taking the time. And I will put it out there, listeners, small disclaimer, I have a small child asleep in my car. If he wakes up, then I will apologize in advance. It's like playing Russian roulette with the sleeping toddler, but it will be fine. Hopefully we have a good opportunity. Bec, let's start with your background. So before we come on to your career today, let's start with sort of your childhood and how you kind of started your love of horses and getting into the industry.
Okay, so anytime anybody asks me, because I don't come from a horsey family, where it started, where I got it from, all I can really say is that there's a picture of me at my very first birthday and I have a My Little Pony in my hands and I'm gripping his legs and my eyes are as big as saucers and I'm just as happy as you can possibly be as a child. And it obviously started young, started strong, and not sure where it came from, but I was obsessed with them as a child, and obviously it grew, and I never really wanted to do anything else if it didn't have to do with horses. Horses have given me literally everything in my life, every opportunity, every position that I'm in right now has come from horses, and I am grateful that love started as a child for whatever reason. I begged and borrowed eventually to be able to ride and get lessons. And you know how you have to beg your parents to let you, because obviously it can be an obsessive sport once you become involved, and they're a bit wary to let you if they're not already horse people themselves. But they caved, and I think I started with one small week-long camp. And after that, I was leasing horses and taking lessons, and as much as I could, I did. My father was in the military, so we were in the military. We moved every year to 2 years, depending, and that obviously didn't give us a lot of opportunities to be able to, you know, stay in a program or continue on with trainers. So if we found someone that was convenient and inexpensive, then I got to ride. And if we didn't, then I hoped that I found a friend that had a horse that I could go pet, at least. So we kind of moved all over, and I would end up in Maine cleaning chicken coops in order to ride the pony that they'd built an arena in the parking lot in the middle of town. And that was the best I could get at the moment, but that was plenty. All of that kind of culminated into, I was good in school, but I didn't really care for college necessarily. And then I found out that you could actually go and ride horses in college. And this seemed like a great idea. So I went ahead and went to school at Virginia Intermont College, which is now no longer, but at the time had a very high level winning riding teams and programs. So I did that, and I majored in arts. I'm a longtime artist and still continue that to this day. So I majored in art and minored in equine science, and pretty much every extracurricular activity was riding. And then outside of school, I ended up having at least 2 to 3 horses at a time that I was training or selling, and you know, getting little free thoroughbreds and then figuring out how to be able to go and ride and event and sell them, as one does. Anytime you get $2 to rub together, you are finding a way to buy another horse. Pre-college, it was, hey, I want to go be a working student. And of course, my parents didn't want that, which is why I went to college. And then, of course, immediately after college, I went to go be a working student. I actually rode with Mike Winter in Noonan, Georgia. And that's kind of where I started building some of my really good long-term friendships to this day with other eventers, Jenny Branigan being one and Jimmy Schramm being another. They're both live here in the same town that I'm in now, or but we're all still friends. And you know how the equestrian community can really bring people together and create strong relationships. So that was sort of the start for me. And all of a sudden I was in real riding. I was going to real events and not just backyard stuff, and starting to kind of tiptoe into professional eventing and competing as a groom and as a rider. And from there, I kind of got out of it for a bit. And then all of a sudden, Jimmy had worked out in California for Tammy Smith, and she was leaving as she had a partner and they were going on to do their own thing. And, you know, Jenny goes, oh, that'd be a great opportunity for you. And I was sort of at that weird point in my early mid-20s where I hadn't really done enough. And I was like, okay, I'm ready for a big change. So I packed everything up and moved across the country, which, you know, felt like a really big deal at the time. And I guess was. And now I've gone back and forth across the country and the world multiple times. So it doesn't maybe seem as much, but it was good. It was an amazing experience to go and compete and work for, you know, what was then and, you know, is now. Tammy is a really top level rider in the country as well as on the West Coast, really dominating. So she had a really good program at the time, kind of still getting started. And I rode for her in grooms and, you know, had my own little horses, and she set me up with some horses to ride. So it was a whole new experience into eventing. And the West Coast is a very different ball game than the East. And it was really cool to be there and experience that. And I, of course, fell in love with California, which is a great place to live.
I was going to say, which came first? Because your introduction to shoeing horses, you're obviously extremely experienced in sort of riding horsemanship at this point. So when did the shoeing come into it? Was that before or after your experience in the circus?
Well, that was before. So that was really Tammy started that. She introduced me to a trainer in California who does like specialty behavioral training, who also happens to be a farrier. And so, of course, anything that we got in training, we shod or trimmed or, you know, took care of. And so that was sort of part of my, all of a sudden I started working for him, and that was part of my duties was, all right, go out to the field and trim those horses. And all right, well, here, hand me this, learn how to do that. And the family, all of them, you know, really good horsemen, riders and farriers alike. And they had these shoeing accounts at Thermal Hits. And so I would ride at Hits in the morning and train horses. And then in the afternoon, I would go and help them and shoe. And it just kind of turned into a thing where I realized it was kind of fun and handy. And I wasn't too bad at it. And I was at that point where I was like, scraping for rides and you know how you do, you're like running around with your helmet on and getting in the car and driving to the next place for a, you know, $15 ride or $20 lesson. And I realized I could go and I could shoe for a farrier for the day, and albeit I worked for free for a long time in order to be able to get to the point where I was good enough that I could be paid, but I could actually make a decent day's wage. And so I started doing that. All of a sudden I was shoeing or assisting 3 days a week, and then riding, you know, 3 days a week. And I loved it. It turned out I actually really liked it. I worked for a great farrier, Blair Cooper, who was shoeing for Susie Hutchinson, you know, kind of when she was dominating in the show jumping arena. He is a really great horseman, a great farrier, very well educated, and a really kind person. And I just realized that, wow, you could do all of it. You could be all the things. You didn't have to be the stereotypical brawny guy and, you know, the stereotype that you can get with some farriers.
Yeah.
He really broke that for me, I think. And I realized that could be something that could be, you know, a possibility. And still at the time, I wasn't thinking like, oh, this is going to be my career. I was just thinking, oh, I can pay my bills and I'm still around horses and I can still ride at night and I can, you know, I was still trying to ride. And I feel bad at the time, or now looking back, because I understand how big of a deal it was, but I was working for him 3 days a week and he wanted to take me on more, and I was going for it. And then all of a sudden the circus came to town, literally.
It's like something out of it. It's like something out of a storybook. Before we go into the circus, can I just ask you about sort of the, obviously you have a serious talent for art, and that was part of your college experience. Was that something that attracted you when you started to enjoy the showing of almost being able to create something out of horses' feet that sort of touched your art, your love of art?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The first guy I worked with, he basically told me that I was taking the hoof capsule and I had to envision it as a sculpture, and I had to take away everything that didn't make my sculpture beautiful. Now, mind you, we have to work within the confines of what the capsule, the hoof capsule can maintain and the horse can create. You can't just go and willy-nilly move things around, but it is, I am, when I see it, I am inherently inclined to see balance and symmetry because of my artistic training and background. And then I can see that in the limb and the hoof capsule and sort of see how to move things around and see how, even when I'm finishing a toe, it technically doesn't affect the movement, the functionality of the horse necessarily. But I can still see, okay, I can make this a prettier picture when you put it on the ground, and a rider or, you know, whoever's going to look at that horse will see, oh, wow, it does look really balanced because you finished it a certain way. So even when I'm working with anyone new to the industry, girls that work for me, I really explain it that way, that you're really looking at it as this sculpture and you have to see that balance because you're trying to paint a picture when you're done, and it needs to be this beautiful picture. So I do. I love it. To this day, I love making my grinds on my shoes pretty, and that very much is an artistic thing. I do. I think every day that I get my artistic kicks out on doing something with the horse in some way, shape, or form. It's a really great outlet for me.
I think that's amazing. And I think it's beautifully explained as well, and something that obviously taps into talents and a passion in you as well. Let's talk about running away to join the circus, because that is essentially then what happened, isn't it?
It is. It's the wildest thing. You know, I mean, even to this day, I did it and I still think it's wild. I was being super melodramatic and oh, I don't want to die in Temecula, California, which is, you know, now like, okay, that'd be a perfectly good place to die if that was the case. But I was just feeling very stuck, and I really hadn't done a lot of things, even though technically, like, I guess I had, I didn't feel like I had, and I felt like I just wanted more. I was stifled. I needed to see the world. And you know how you put those feelings and emotions into your heart and they kind of get sent out into the universe. And I feel like I got back my answer in a mutual friend introduced me to his sister, who was an aerialist in the show. We got tickets to go and watch, and the opening act started. And because I'd already had a background in this sort of, you could say natural horsemanship, it's behavioral horsemanship, I saw the first act and I was like, wait a minute, I could do that. I could totally do that. And I watched, I'm like, wait a minute, I could do that too. And looking back now, actually having experienced it, I realized how hard it was what they were doing. They made it look more simple, but the premise was there. I had this spark that, wow, this is something that could be really interesting. I never thought that you could, I never had seen a show like this. I'd always heard of it, that show, Cavalia, but I'd never seen it. And so I didn't realize that it could have been a possibility. And of course, you know, we meet the aerialist, Katie, and we go out, and she's like, yeah, that'd be so much fun. You should just do it. Because once you know aerialists and you know circus people, the idea that you run away with the circus is not this big, weird, crazy idea. It actually happens. People do it. And so it seems very feasible and reasonable. And she was like, yeah, you should send an audition video. You just do it. And I went ahead. It took me a while. It took me about 2 weeks. I scrimped and got horses together to work on, and Nikki Clark, who's a Grand Prix dressage rider, lent me her lovely upper level horse and allowed me to put together my dressage video and train some horses to do some tricks, which now looking back is not maybe not that big of a deal, but put together a little video and sent it in, and they just happened to need a rider that looked similar to another rider to do a pas de deux. And I came in, got the call to come in for an interview. I dressed in my like best California dressage gear and realized that I was way overdressed and not really what wasn't the circus vibe. But I don't know if you've been to California much, but just the popped collars, the long sleeves and the turquoise and the, you know, fancy breeches and all those. And I was thinking I was so cool. And everybody's so laid back and chill and, you know, like bohemian pants and tank tops riding these nice Lusitanos or Andalusians. I'm like, okay. So they hand me this crazy little Andalusian. I think it's Arabian cross. They swore it wasn't. But they hand them to me and they go, okay, well, this is the horse that, you know, if you were to get the job, you'd have to ride. He's a little quirky, but you've got 15 minutes and show us what you've got. And then they literally crossed their arms and stood in the middle of the circus top arena, because you had the big top and then you had the other tents around it, and that was our dressage arena. And they're like, okay, go on. And luckily, the training that I'd had and the very give, pressure, release, light sort of training really worked well with that horse. And we got on, and he knew everything. He knows every trick. He knows way more than I even know today. It was great. You know, we're passaging, piaffing, pirouetting around, and he's lovely. And I'm like, I'm totally in love with this. And I'm thinking I'm killing it. I'm like, this is great. I'm going to be amazing. And I get off, and they're like, okay, well, yep, that was good. And we talk, whatnot, and come to find out, yes, of course, I did get the job. And that little horse, as lovely as he was on that first day, never, never once showed any ounce of that enthusiasm on stage. The times I came off stage crying because that horse, who I knew could Spanish walk front and back of that arena, wouldn't take one Spanish walk step on command on stage. I would just come off bawling, looking like an idiot. But that little guy, he knew his job, and he knew the second he was on stage, he did not have to do a thing you were asking. But Prata, the little Andalusian, I still love him. He's a lovely little guy, but he was a tough cookie. So, yeah.
Quirky, yeah, taught you a thing or two along the way. So when you joined the circus, what was your role? Obviously, for anybody that isn't familiar with the show, or obviously there is the degree of dressage riding and that kind of the tricks and everything else. But what did you do? Could you kind of mold that, or was it a case of learning as to what they wanted you to do?
Oh, yeah. It was very much a role was already set. The act had been created, which is what happens. They create these acts, and the creators of them perform them and develop them. And then it's pretty much in stone, unless you have to change something due to a horse's capability, or, you know, if you don't have the actors to do what needs to be done. So I came in as for the pas de deux. I was specifically hired for that. So I was a princess dressed in white with a flowing dress on a white Andalusian, and my partner was in the same, and we performed I thought it was the most lovely, beautiful act they had. You enter in with a waterfall and you walk behind a waterfall screen. It actually was a waterfall on stage. And then the curtains come up and the lights come on and we performed this lovely pas de deux and, you know, Spanish walk, pirouette, passage, piaf. And we had this lovely white background looking like a castle, and we were the princesses, and we rode around each other, and it was supposed to be this very lovely and serene act. And I remember the first day I performed it, of course a few friends came out, and the only thing I could think was how happy I was that you could only really see the first few rows, because I was shaking like a leaf, and I was supposed to do this very like serene smile at the end. We're right next to the audience, and I could barely keep my face straight. I'm shaking. I'm sure it was a grimace, not a smile, but you couldn't see too far into the audience. Thank goodness. I couldn't see. There was 1,600 people there watching, but it was a beautiful, beautiful act. I really enjoyed it, and I performed that for 2-3 years, maybe 2.5 years before it left the show.
And I was going to say, so you had obviously moved from the East Coast to the West Coast of the US, but actually your circus journey then took you even further afield and you managed to be able to travel the world as far as afield as Australia. Is that right?
Yeah. So it literally, I performed in San Diego for 1 week and then the tour took a 3-month break because that's kind of how long it took them to be able to clean everything and organize everything to get into Australia, because Australia is obviously very strict about allowing anything into the country that could disturb the habitat. And we obviously were bringing in horses and lots of dirt. Everything had to be clean and organized. So I went on a 3-month break and I continued my life in California for that 3 months. And then I hopped on a plane and I moved to Brisbane, Australia. From there, we toured Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and Perth. So I did the whole round trip of Australia. And what's cool about the show is that you perform for 3 months and then you get about 10 days off. And so in that 10 days, you get a stipend and you get to go do whatever you want for that 10 days. And so I went to New Zealand, I went to Bali, I went on long camping trips in Australia, we went to different areas of Australia. From there, I went to Thailand and Vietnam and all these different places in between performing in the countries that we were in. So not only were the countries we were in amazing, but then so were our vacations. It was really a sweet gig.
That's amazing. So when did the desire to go back home and sort of focus full time on your farriery come around?
Well, so I actually worked with the original Cavalia for 3 years and we toured Europe and then we moved into Asia. Asia was amazing. But then we eventually moved into China. And at this point, I had already... dressage, obviously, coming from an eventing background, gets a little boring, a little kind of quickly. So I had moved into doing trick riding, and which I loved, I adored, and to this day I still miss. And I had also moved into doing aerials. So I had started doing a lot of acts in the show. Even as much as I did aerials, and I loved it, and I actually did look at pursuing careers strictly in aerials, I couldn't see myself leading the horses. And so we'd lived in China for about 6 months, and it was a really great experience. It just got a little old at a certain point in time. China got kind of old. I was feeling like I was doing all these things in the show. I was 32 maybe. I was feeling like I was kind of getting to that age where I was like, all right, I need some more responsibility. I need more things. I need something more fulfilling than this. Like, where am I going with this? It was the combination of, feeling a little unfulfilled that I was doing all of these acts. I was now in the solo haute école high school dressage act. As soon as I got off my horse, I changed my clothes and then was in the aerial act and the same act. Like it was a lot. So I just felt a little, if one could say bored, I guess bored. And I was missing my friends and they were doing things. And I felt like maybe it was time for me to go back to the States. So I'd been away for 3 years. So I moved back. I went back to California because at that point, I didn't really have a home anymore, obviously. Everything had just been sent to my parents. Of course, now a friend of mine had moved into another show and she just goes, oh, you should just come visit me. Come see the show. They'd love to meet you. And it was the sister act to Cavalia. It was a larger production called Odysseo. And I went just to hang out for New Year's Eve, I believe, and see the show. And of course, I saw the show and it was lovely. It was beauty, beauty, beautiful. The riding wasn't quite as high a quality as Cavalia, but the imagination that went into making this a gorgeous production was really phenomenal. And so there again, I go, okay, well, I guess I don't really know what else I'm doing. And this is a really cool show. And if they'll hire me to do all the aerial acts I want to do, because I really loved it, I'll go ahead and do it. And so thankfully they liked me well enough. And they hired me to do 2 aerial acts, 2 or 3 of the riding acts. Yeah. So then all of a sudden I was back into it again. And it sort of got to the same point. I did that for about a year, year and a half. And at a certain point I was living in California now because we traveled just on the West Coast mostly. and my friends were sort of there, but not quite there. And the horse industry was there, but not quite there. I was just outside of it. What it came down to is I felt like I really wanted a dog. And I started looking, and I really missed having my dog. And I found a little mutt who I have, and she's in the car with me now. And I found her, and I go, you know what? I think it's time for me to move on. I think I'm gonna adopt this dog. And there was a horse in the show that I really wanted to adopt as well. And I was like, okay, I'm going to adopt this horse, and I'm going to adopt this dog, and I'm going to go do something else. And I don't know what, but I'm going to go do it. And so I left. And I didn't know at that time if I was going to shoe, although I had really considered it. And I had sort of been talking to and working with the farriers at the show, like, all that time. And again, Jenny stepped into my life and said, oh, well, Scott Keach in Florida needs somebody. Why don't you come to Florida and work for this show jumper, Scott Keach? And I was like, all right, great, sure, I'll do that. And so I quit. I adopted Mia. I took Raz, my new thoroughbred, and we moved to Florida. And I gave myself the liberty of saying, this has been a long 4 years. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm going to take a year off to decide. And I had, believe it or not, the circus pays pretty decent. And I didn't have any expenses. I didn't have a car. I didn't pay for a house. I didn't have medical. I had everything covered. So I'd been able to save a lot of money. And so I took a year and I said, okay, I'm going to figure things out. And in that year, I worked for Scott and I met his farrier, Chris Martelli. And I started riding with Chris and saying, okay, I'm going to see if I want to do this. So I'd work all week at the farm. And then on my day off, I'd go and I'd help shoe. And that was sort of my, okay, am I going to do this again? And of course, you know, Jenny came back in and said, all right, well, hey, you should meet my farrier, Steve Teachman. He's the U.S. team farrier. If you want to work with a good farrier, he's the farrier. I'm like, okay, all right, I'll go work with him. So I rode with him for a day and said, you know, this is something I think I'd like to pursue. If you're interested, let me know. And he said, okay, come on up for an interview. I went up to Unionville, Pennsylvania, interviewed for 3 days. I had a job offer on the table to be the head trainer at a multidiscipline farm. And I had his offer to come and shoe. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go be a farrier. I can't turn down the opportunity to work with, you know, Steve Teachman, U.S. team farrier. Who says no to that? And I was not dumb. And I took the job. And there's where it started. Full time.
That's amazing. So what influence has Steve had on your career?
All of it. All of it. The entire thing. Steve is the driving influence of my career. I would not be where I'm at without Steve Teachman. And I am not dumb. I am well aware that I got extremely lucky. Now, mind you, I work very, very hard, and I had a really good base with a lot of locals that, you know, they've known me in the industry as a rider, but they've seen me around. So I'm a familiar face, but Steve has introduced me to everyone. He really has. I can never thank him enough for what he's done for me as far as my career and my personal life. Cause if anyone who knows him knows that he's a really just a great human, him and his partner, Laura. So I still work in a lot of the barns that Steve worked in. I've got some of my, you know, ones that were outside of him as well, but most people know me because I worked for Steve. So I am well aware that Steve has really created my career and has allowed me to be able to step into the role that I have, as quickly as I did. And I will be forever grateful. He was an amazing mentor and teacher. And I know the things that I know today because he taught them to me are just expansive. It's really amazing. I never imagined it would have been such a great experience to work for him, but it was. And I miss working with him every day. You know, we did that every single day for years. And it's kind of weird sometimes not to see him every day.
I have no doubt that your hard work and talent came into it as well. Let me ask you, because you mentioned a little bit earlier on in the show about obviously working in what has been a male-dominated industry. What has it been like? What has your experience been like? And how have you sort of, I guess, paved a way, hopefully, for other people to follow in your footsteps as well?
Gosh, I sure hope that that's the case. I really, really do. It's funny because the West Coast has far more female farriers than the East Coast does. It's kind of weird to go from the one to the other because I started working with females in California one of my best friends is a farrier back there, and she's tinier than me and covered in tattoos, and now she's a mom to two, and she's awesome. She's amazing. And there's a lot of like really strong, independent, beautiful women out there that are doing this job. But all of a sudden you come to the East Coast and they're like, what? You're a female? Women don't do this. It's not a girl's job. And it, the times that I hear comments like that, or wow, I've never seen a woman farrier before. Literally have had people take video of me because it's this weird thing for them. It's good. I mean, I like it. I like being an anomaly. I like doing things different. I've always marched my own drum. It never occurred to me that it was something I couldn't do because I was a woman. And I adore that I have several young women working for me now. And I encourage anyone that wants to do the job that this is such an empowering position to be in, because you are financially stable. You are still working with horses and doing the things you love. There are so many ways to mold this career. You can do it full time and crazy like I am. You can do it part time. You can be an assistant. You can do a trim job. You just do trim. I think it's a really great industry to be in for women. And I wish I could find one really cool girl out there that wanted to apprentice and make it her full time gig. Right now, I've got a few girls that they work for multiple people, which is a great way to pursue it as well. But you know, a lot of them have come out of the schools that they have, and a lot more women are going to the schools, which I encourage as well. It's a great start for your education. It's not entirely necessary, but it is a good start. So I hope to see a lot more women out there breaking that stereotype. I think so long as you understand that this is about technique, this is about a love for horses. You don't have to have brute strength. You really do need to learn how to use your tools, use your hands, have good technique and have a lot of patience with the horses and actually want to be here and do it. And there's no stopping you. It doesn't matter how tiny you are, or you know, you don't have to be as super strong, but yeah, it's a great career field.
I absolutely love that you are setting a standard and sort of being a role model for other women. And if you're listening to this, listeners, and you think it's something that actually you would like to pursue in terms of farriery as a career or something that you want to look into further, then do it. You know, Beck has proven that it is entirely possible to do it at the very, very top level. Beck, before we let you go, I just quickly want to ask you, we're obviously in summer, so can we just pick your brains for a few top tips on how to keep our horses' hooves in the best possible condition?
Oh yeah, this one's so tough because the answers, no one ever likes this answer. Don't turn them out at night, which is obviously not going to happen because there's too many flies and it's too hot during the day. Turning them out as late as possible, bringing them in as early as possible. The problem is the moisture in the grass. So you're going out into the moisture in the grass, they're stomping around in that all night, and then they come into the stall with the shavings and then their feet dry out. So there's this wet, dry, wet, dry. That is what expands and contracts the feet. That's what's popping clinches on shoes. That's what loosens nails, and nails become loosened. You're more likely to lose a shoe, right? The hoof walls are just saturated right now. So drying your horse's legs and feet off after you wash them, trying to have them as dry as possible, as long and often as possible. I don't use oil products on my horse's feet. I usually don't recommend that at all. We're not trying to create, the capsule needs to be the same moisture as the properties around it. So it needs to be the same moisture as the ground or as the grass. So if you're trying to dry a foot out, but the ground is really wet, then yeah, that's not going to work well for your foot. You're not trying to keep it more moisturized if it's really dry inside, because then your foot's too soft. So keeping it, drying them off once you get them wet. I use Keratex 2 to 3 times a week. That's a drying, it'll actually harden the hoof wall. It binds the proteins. It has a formaldehyde inside of it, so it actually does bind proteins in the hoof. So Keratex 2 to 3 times a week. I've been using Durasol quite a bit on my soles. That keeps them a little bit drier, hardens them up, just keeps that sole nice and tough so that we can try to, as the horse's feet are stomping on the ground at flies, you can try to keep them in shape. And going out with bell boots, please go out with bell boots. Shoeing is expensive. I'll be the first one to say that. It's expensive. Go out with bell boots. Don't just do it. Try to keep those shoes on as best you can. Yeah, and actually another like weird thing that has seemed to work is polysaccharide. So a triple thick super glue. is actually doing wonders for several of my horses. And if you can put that on once or twice a week as well, you can get it on Amazon, the triple thick super glue. Works well. Somebody's having to do glue patches, always use the triple thick super glue on there. You can do it once or twice a week. It'll build up a layer. It's not the prettiest looking, but it will keep the moisture out of those feet, especially if you're turning out at night or if you're turning out in the rain.
Okay, amazing. Beck, thank you so much. Your career has just been absolutely extraordinary. I feel like we could have dug into every single area in more detail. Really appreciate it. You are an absolute inspiration to other women who hopefully listening to this will think, oh, actually, that might be something that I would be really interested in. Are you on social media? If anybody wants to come and follow your journey as well, we can point them in that direction.
I am a little anti-social media, I have to be honest. I am on Facebook. I do not go on Facebook very often, but I do actually get messages on there. So sending me anything through Messenger, I do check that, mainly because I'm obsessed with Facebook Marketplace. So it's Beck Ratté on Facebook. My business is Ratté Equine Solutions. You can look me up there. It's RattéEquine@yahoo.com. That's my email. That's RATTE. So yeah, if anybody does want to reach out, especially any woman that's interested in the career, I'm always happy to chat about it. I think it's great. I'd be happy to point them in the direction of other farriers. I'd be happy to mentor them as well. There's a lot of us out there looking for good help and willing to, you know, it can be a very good paying career. So I'm super encouraging of anybody that wants to reach out, please do.
That is amazing, Beck. Thank you so, so much. Listeners, we hope that you have enjoyed a really special insight. And we will be back soon with more on the USCA official podcast. Thanks for listening to the USCA official podcast. If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we would love to hear from you. Get in touch through any of our social media platforms at US Eventing, and don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform to make sure you don't miss an episode.